This is Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we have a conversation with Daisy Lee. She's the environmental science teacher with the Michigan City Area Schools at the Kruger Outdoor Environmental Center. It's a middle school that is in Michigan City that has a number of projects going and had released at the end of the school year and to continue on into the next school year that involve food recycling and composting, among other things. We'll find out more. We also have another conversation, actually two, from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University for you today. And we'll revisit our conversation with Steve Beekman, who's the executive director of the Northwest Indiana Food Bank. They moved into their new headquarters in Merivale, and they have some very ambitious projects for the years ahead. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. From time to time, we get to highlight things that the Michigan City Area Schools is accomplishing for not only the students who attend the schools in Michigan City, but also the community at large. One of the things is something that the school district's Kruger Outdoor Environmental Science Center has been doing here to help not only educate students about the importance of the environmental issues we face, like dealing with recycling and trash and with composting as well, but also helping the community in many different aspects here. And with us to talk about it, we have environmental science teacher Daisy Lee. Daisy, thank you for being with us on Regionally Speaking.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, first, if you will, for folks here in the rest of Northwest Indiana that aren't familiar with what the Kruger Outdoor Environmental Science Center is, tell us about that first.
Absolutely. So Kruger Middle School is a public environmentally themed middle school here in Michigan City, and we have environmental science classes, which is required for all students, along with their regular science class. So they get a full year of regular science, and then they get a half a year, so one semester of environmental science, mm-hmm. both in 7th and 8th grade. And if they pass environmental science with an A or B, then they get high school credits for that. We also have environmental shop class, environmental computer class, environmental art class, and about 113 acres of land, including woods, that we are students in the environmental shop class have made four different trail systems for our community to use, but also we host environmental field days every year where we invite our first through sixth graders from the district and our seventh and eighth graders go out on the trails with them and teach them different environmental activities.
Wow, that sounds like it's quite a program for folks in Michigan City and certainly the students who attend the schools there in Michigan City Area Schools.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great program.
The things we wanted to focus on in our conversation today, first off, start in talking about a very interesting and rather innovative food recycling program that is underway. And I know this is a program that's kind of in hiatus right now, I imagine, because it's the summer break. But during the regular academic year, it seems to be going full blast, it seems like. And I understand the program is something that you helped start back in April. Tell us about how the food recycling program got started and the different stages or components maybe might be a better way to describe it that this program has going for it.
We've been trying to compost in the cafeteria for a couple of years now, but haven't quite found the correct system. And so this year I came up with the 5-stage system. So I made signs for kids to follow. So the first stage was the share table. So any unopened food that they hadn't eaten, that they hadn't touched, that goes in the share table. Then we had composting buckets where they would put all of their open food or food that they've already taken a bite out of. That goes in those buckets. And that also included meat and cheese and milk, which is something that doesn't go in a traditional compost because it creates terrible smells and it can attract critters. But our compost bin is far enough away from the school and it's reinforced with chicken wire so that critters can't get in and it doesn't smell. So the goal of our compost is to reduce the amount that we're putting into the landfill. Uh-huh. And so stage 3 is recycling. So anything else that can be recycled, any cans, any plastic bottles. But also at that station, we partner with an organization called TerraCycle, and they take materials that you can't normally recycle. So kit bags, for example. So So we also collect chip bags, and we put those to the side. And then TerraCycle pays for shipping for us to send them the chip bags, and then we earn points with them, which we can then exchange for money to go back to the school. And then station four is your regular garbage, which not much ended up there.
I imagine not.
The plastic, yeah, basically the plastic silverware. That was a lot of it. And then station five was the plastic trays that they used to carry all of their food on.
Oh, wow. So it sounds like this is a good comprehensive way to be able to deal with not only everything that normally would get tossed out and end up in the landfill, or maybe nominally recycled, I would imagine. Like you say, you're able to recycle some things that would say that the Michigan City Community Recycling Program couldn't take in. It sounds like, and especially in the case of the plastic bags and things like that. And I also, too, want to bring into one of the other components that you mentioned as well, too, that you're able to kind of partner with a community business to help take care of some of the food scraps that the students leave behind from the cafeterias as well. Let's go into a little more detail here, Daisy Lee, about these various areas. If people are not familiar with the Share Table, and then they've probably seen it at their school cafeteria if they have youngsters that attend, and maybe they've been in there during lunchtime, they see things there. The Share Table is a pretty popular place, I would imagine, because some youngsters have a chance to kind of pick and choose something that maybe they didn't necessarily like that was on their tray ahead of time. Or when they went through line, I guess, they can find something else that might be tasty. And in this case, too, if it's not being eaten at all, it's gone to some good use. How much material comes in on the average at the Share Table?
Originally, before we had this system going, we were getting, I don't know, 5 to 10 bags of apples each day, and then a few bananas and a couple of other random things, because kids were just throwing everything away.
Right.
That, you know, that's all they knew, and it's not their fault, right? They didn't know. And so they were throwing everything away. But with this system, they had to put everything on their tray exactly where it belongs. And I also had 7th and 8th grade volunteers help me with the stations. So they would volunteer each day and stand at the stations and help the kids understand what goes where. And so with the Share Table, they can put all their unopened and uneaten food. And so kids would come up and take whatever they wanted if they wanted something extra. But everything left over, the cafeteria staff would then hold until the end of the week in their fridge, and then on Friday they would donate it to a local homeless shelter.
Wow, that's great. That's great. Is this an idea in the system, so to speak, that you maybe have heard about from other school districts, or was this something that maybe the folks in the community said, hey, you know, we'd like to get more material to go to the homeless shelters to help the folks that have to use the shelters out?
Yeah, this was started by our cafeteria staff before the composting. So they'd been doing this for months, and we didn't even know about it.
Really?
Recently.
Oh. Well, congratulations to the cafeteria staff for coming up with such an innovative idea and helping the community out, too. I'm sure that they probably got the word in and said, you know, we know about this homeless shelter here in Michigan City, but they'd love to have some items to be able to feed the folks that come in, but there's not enough coming in that we can bring in, so let's find ways to bring more food in on a regular basis. Like you say, it's saved up every week, and by the end of the week, they make the delivery to the homeless shelter. So the folks that come into the shelter can pretty much count on having something extra to eat, I would imagine.
Absolutely. And since this program, the composting program, they have 10 times or more at the end of each week to donate to the homeless shelter. Mm-hmm. So it's a win-win in every aspect.
Wow. Now let's go into more detail here, if you will, about the composting program. You were talking a little bit here about some of the items that normally don't go into maybe a home composting program because of the type of thing it is. You mentioned certain things like that have to be, I guess, not meat type or milk type because of the like you say, the smells, the fact it attracts animals and things like that. But tell us more about how this program that the Michigan City Area Schools has set up through the Kruger Center to be able to compost these items.
One of our outdoor days that we host is called Living History, and we bring the fourth graders in for that. And our seventh and eighth graders go back to pioneer time, and they have different stations that represent what life was like then. And one of the stations was a composting station. So we have our environmental shop kids built a composting bin about 20 feet long, about 5 feet high, and about 4 feet wide.
Wow.
And it has four different sections. And so the idea is to show what materials can be broken down and what materials can't. And so to compare the 1800s to today's garbage. And so we had two sections for compost and then sections for plastic. And so the kids could see what breaks down and what doesn't. And so with such a big area, and this composting bin is pretty far away from the school, probably about 500 feet.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And it's into the woods. And so we put chicken wire in it also so that critters can't get in. And so we can put anything in it. We can put meat and we can put cheese and we can put milk. So that's what attracts the critters.
Yeah, those are things that those are things you can't have at your home composting operation because you're too close to it. Even you could have a big backyard and it still would be probably too close to the house to be able to handle these items without attracting the critters that are out there, as you say. Now, have you had the composting operation in operation long enough to be able to turn it through with everything else that you mix in together, that not only the food scraps and the other things, to come up with some good compost out of it yet?
We do. We have some really great soil at the bottom. We haven't harvested yet.
Yeah.
But we've been doing the compost program since April 30th. Mm-hmm. And so we do have quite a bit.
Wow.
But we haven't harvested any of it yet. So that'll be done in the fall.
Okay. Now, what do you hope to be able to use that that fresh compost on when you're able to harvest it?
We're not sure yet.
Another idea for the students to come up with. That's a good idea because I'm sure that the landscaping staff with the Michigan City Area Schools would love to have something to add to the landscaping material. They probably get tired of having to buy a bunch of bags of material to mix in to be able to keep the shrubs and the other plants going, and probably it would be a good addition to maybe creating another garden of some type out there too, I would imagine.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Okay. Well, let's talk now here. You mentioned about the recycling. Of course, it's a component of all of this, of course, within the Kruger Outdoor Environmental Science Center in Michigan City. But you've been able to basically expand, I guess, the recycling program to add on some materials, especially some of these items that are not easily recyclable. Tell us about this.
With the recycling in the cafeteria, some numbers for you. We've recycled 361 pounds within the month that we were doing the program.
Okay.
Just in the cafeteria. And each of the classrooms in our school does have a recycling bin, and we recycle regularly. But some of those extra things, so plastic bags, all of our apples come in plastic bags, and then chip bags, you know, hot chips are very popular. So we partnered with TerraCycle to collect those chip bags. And for the plastic bags, those actually go to another place as well, and they make different furniture out of them. They make park benches, or they make birdhouses out of the plastic bags that you can't normally recycle in your regular recycling.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you do with the trays? As you say, they're also managed to be recycled as well, too. How are those handled, and as far as you know, those are going toward being making?
The plastic trays are reusable, so those go back to the cafeteria staff, and they wash them and reuse them every day.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So it's a good way to be able to keep them out of the trash bin as well, too, and in turn out of the landfill. Well, it sounds like that Daisy, that there's some great things happening. One other thing, too, that I wanted to bring out is how not only is the school district working on this project, but also you've been able to get the cooperation of a local business, a company called Quality Beet. Tell us what they're beginning to get out of this as well, that you all not only educating students on the proper way to handle the environment and all of the other issues that go along with it, but this way they've been able to help, I guess, probably help their business along too.
Tim Bauer, who's the owner of Quality Beet, he is a social scientist, and he focuses on sustainability. And so when he opened up his coffee shop / grocery store, he wanted to make sure that it was sustainable and he had the least amount of waste that he could possibly produce in his business.
Mm-hmm.
And so we partnered together, and so each week we meet up and he gives me all of his compost from the shop. So any food that may have gone bad or banana peels and orange peels and coffee grounds. He makes smoothies, so any of the other leftover pulp or any of the leftover skins from the smoothies, those come here, and then those get composted too.
That's great. That sounds like a great idea. Now that we're into the summer months here, you're kind of on a break now, obviously, not only from school, but probably from some of these projects. Come fall, when the students are back at the schools, and in particular there at Kruger, what's going to happen with the programs? It'll be just fired back up and put into operation again?
Exactly. And over the summer, I still take my personal compost, and I take compost from Quality Bead over there in the summer. But in the fall, we will start right back up at day one. And this year, I made sure to train 7th and 8th graders who are interested. And I took volunteers because I wanted people who were interested in doing it and interested in helping out. And I have a lot of 7th graders, probably about 20 from this past year, who will then transfer over to the fall. And they already know the whole game, and so then they can teach the new 7th graders coming in.
That's great. That's great to hear. Do you think that maybe some of these things, even though that we know that Kruger is an environmental science-themed middle school, that some of these things may get shifted over perhaps to the high school?
That would be wonderful. Just looking at our numbers from 1 month of doing this, we composted 913 pounds of food and 361 pounds of recycling, where all of that was left out of the landfill, plus all of the food that was in the share table. We didn't weigh that. And so if that just happened in 1 month at our middle school, if we could transfer this to other schools and inspire other schools to take this on, we could make a huge difference in our landfills.
And certainly help the administration out in the costs that they have to deal with in trying to deal with the trash collection and disposal costs that they have to face as well, too. Well, Daisy, it sounds like a great program is underway at Kruger Middle School with the Environmental Science Center and these different types of projects that are all part of the overall food recycling program, the different components of it. And Daisy, I guess congratulations to you and everybody else that helps you out, and to all the students that have been participating in the program so far here at the end of this past school year, and the best of luck going into the new school year ahead.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Daisy Lee is an environmental science teacher with the Michigan City Area Schools. She's working with the Kruger Middle School's Outdoor Environmental Science Center. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Our next segment comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
Of course, in high school, the rivalries between the different communities and the sections of Gary where you lived was huge. To describe the rivalries, it's just something that was inbred. You knew it. You heard the stories of the generations before you. Most of us had older brothers and sisters that carried it on to us, and that the same thing had happened to them. Etna was looked upon as the doormat. We were, for lack of better words, the kids from the other side of the track. And a lot of us, it reflected in our personalities, and I can be quite honestly tell you that a lot of us had a chip on our shoulder because of it. We weren't as affluent or successful as the folks on the other side of the tracks in Miller. We shared this Etna and Miller in the Glen Ryan section, which is the eastern section of sectors of Gary. Well, the kids that grew up in Glen Ryan were kind of in the middle, and then there was us. You have to understand that back in the day, Miller was a very affluent community with an extreme amount of successful people. A lot of your Jewish merchants were Miller residents that lived in Miller and had businesses in Gary. So for us growing up in Etna, we always felt inferior to the people in Miller and found at times it was hard to fit in as well. I mean, you can still to this day run into folks if you're in a restaurant in Gary and Miller where we grew up, and you know, the first thing that in the back of your mind, you may not say it now, but the first thing in the back of your mind is you remember that was the guy that was from Miller, not Etna. And there was a special bond for us from Etna because we felt like we were in a war against the rest, especially when it came to the kids we interacted with in Miller. I remember having several experiences. I had an experience once in high school that I always remember. we had had football practice, and then a friend of mine had given me a ride home, and one of our friends that was on the team with us that came from a pretty affluent family and lived in Miller. He had a family, had a beach home, and great kid, but apparently he never knew we were from the other side of the tracks, because when he found out we were from Aetna, he never spoke to us again. I remember getting dropped off in front of my house, and he was with my buddy that dropped us off, and he said, well, who lives here? Because we just lived in average two-bedroom wood structure homes and nothing fancy, but it was a wonderful place. And so, yes, we always, being from Aetna, we always had a chip on our shoulder that we were from the wrong side of the tracks.
Music's always been a major part of my life. Actually, my parents, there was a theater in Chicago called the Regal Theater. And when I was growing up, as early as 2 years old, I can remember going over to the Regal and seeing people like Duke Ellington and Count Basie and Sarah Vaughan and all the top jazz people as I grew up. We lived upstairs on the second floor of my godmother's house. The piano actually was given to me by another godmother that I had. So we got the piano, and my mother said, well, you'll be taking piano lessons. Okay, you know. But the piano was on the front porch where I could look out and see everybody running up and down the street playing. So the deal was that I was going to practice every day for an hour, no matter what. And this friend would come over, and he'd be sitting there because he wanted to go out and play. And I can remember him saying, can you hurry up? You know what I'm saying? There's no way to hurry up an hour. It is what it is. I tell people now, you know, I've never seen anybody make a dime playing hide and seek. Eventually, I grew to love it. You know, I'd be at the piano for 4 hours and not one. I really didn't actually learn how to play jazz until I got out of college and started rubbing elbows with other people who actually played the music. And I learned from them and kind of on the job training, really. I had a trio, then I had a quartet, and then I formed a band that had five pieces. And at that time, there were about 30 different clubs in Gary where you could go from one spot and play, and the next weekend you could play someplace else. And we would actually, on our breaks, run from one club to the other to listen to another guy play and then come back and play some more. So that's really how this all got started. The thing is about jazz is that we have access to it. There's some things that some minorities don't even have access to. The symphony was something that we didn't have equal access to. You know, so you couldn't prove your mettle there. But jazz, you always could. It's one of the, I guess, racial forerunners in it, because there have been mixed bands since when? Whether you're white or black, once you hit the bandstand, then you're on your own. If you can play, you can play. If you can't, you know, you can't. And it's obvious to everybody. And I guess it's the same way in sports. It's an equalizer. Once here at the university, we played with a guy named Red Rodney. He was a white guy that played with Charlie Parker. He was telling us the story of when they went down south, he had red hair, kind of a light complexion. So they billed him as Albino Red, you know, because the mixed bands couldn't travel the south. When Duke Ellington went south, he rented a set of Pullman cars, and the guys would just travel the south. They wouldn't do hotels. Blacks couldn't stay in the regular hotels, so they worked off of the Pullman cars. Well, there's a jazz musician named Clark Terry, and he had played in this band that used to go down to Cairo, Illinois, and my mother used to see that band. And he played in Duke Ellington's band for about 9 years, and so I was riding in the car with him, and I was saying, I know you used to play in Eddie Randall's band, and you guys used to go down to Cairo and play. And he said, oh, yeah, that's that city where the guy came up on the bandstand and cut Duke Ellington's tie in half. Those are the kinds of things that used to, you know, can you imagine a man of Duke Ellington's stature having something like that happen? My take on the whole thing is that all of the races on the planet were put here by God. All of us have different takes on things. If everybody would work together, you know, my strength might help you and your strength might help. It's like a puzzle. All the pieces of the puzzle can't be the same. You know, they have to be different. The differences are really a strength. I don't see why you would want to be by everybody that's just like you. If everybody were like me, it might be kind of sad, you know. I need somebody that plays the saxophone. I don't need a bunch of piano players.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeprojectoneword.valpo.edu. Indiana Youth Institute has put out an op-ed piece penned by next guest here on Regionally Speaking by Tammy Silverman, who's the executive director of the IYI. And the topic name for this op-ed piece is called Building a Healthier State from the Child Up. Tammy, thank you for joining us today.
Always my pleasure, Chris. Happy to be here.
Well, if you will, fill us in with the topic and why that particular title for it.
Certainly. Well, right now there is a new initiative going on across the state called the Alliance for a Healthier Indiana. And this is a group of healthcare professionals, the Hospital Association, a couple of the big hospital firms, as well as some of those state agencies, Public Health and FSSA. And they started looking at four big issues for health in Indiana. And the role we're playing is looking at what that means for kids, right? Where does Indiana's health for, how are our children doing on some of those really important health metrics?
And unfortunately, how did the ranking show Indiana?
Well, unfortunately, right now, Indiana ranks 35th overall for children's health in the United States. So 35th out of 50. It shows that we have some significant room to grow, particularly in the areas of smoking, infant mortality, obesity, and opioid use disorder.
Now, these are topics that we've brought up in many times before in past discussions and problems that Indiana has. It doesn't sound like this report tells us anything really new, does it?
It's not. But I think one of the important things, particularly, you know, recently we've heard an awful lot about infant mortality. And right now there is that is an area that we continue to struggle with, as well as the opioid use disorder.
Yeah.
I will tell you, though, I think we've kind of, because those things have been so front and center, that the impact of smoking on our kids, as well as the obesity rate, sometimes feel like those stories that we've already covered enough, if you will. But unfortunately, it's still a struggle for kids in Indiana, and so we still need to keep talking about it.
When you've had a chance to do the research on this here, what are we finding as well? We talk about the problems with the opioid abuse disorder among adults, but what do the figures seem to show as far as young people, babies and children alike?
Well, what we know is that obviously newborns who are exposed to opioids before they're born, they have a 60 to 80% likelihood of suffering from what's called neonatal abstinence syndrome, mm-hmm. which is, you know, a mouthful, but it really does affect their long-term language abilities, their cognitive abilities, academic achievement, as well as their long-term growth. So big issues there. We also know that kids who are growing up in homes where opioids are present are, just by being there and by there's secondary traumatic stress. And so they're really dealing with what that means to live in that stressful situation where they may be exposed to acute neglect. We're finding that a lot of those parents don't actively abuse the kids. They're not intentionally harming them, but their addiction may cause them to neglect those kids, and which could have some really long-term consequences.
Now, what kind of information do you folks there at the Indiana Youth Institute get from the Indiana Department of Child Services on this particular topic? Anything new or anything in particular that you're learning?
Well, we are. We're talking to them. You know, they've had a huge increase in the number of children that have been removed from their homes, and they say that the number one cause is that parental substance abuse, and particularly opioids. It's not the only one, but it is what's caused that jump in the last 3 years in particular. So what we're really doing is working with them to figure out how can we help all of those support networks for kids, be it grandparents, aunts, uncles, teachers, coaches, youth group leaders. We know those kids that are in those homes are struggling an awful lot, and the more that we as adults can wrap around them and provide them additional supports, the better off they'll be long term.
Now we're into the summer months, or at least something like it now, and we're finding with the fact that school's out and there are not more opportunities for such events happening during the summer months before school starts in the fall. Are we finding more activities around the state of Indiana that you folks at the IYI are noting that are helping to educate the public on these issues or to help in some small way resolve them?
Certainly. Well, and like I said, the Alliance for a Healthier Indiana, which is, they're doing kind of a statewide roadshow talking about these issues, and we're joining them on that roadshow to talk about all four of those issues. I will say summertime is one of those things where we need to make sure our kids are active, that we need to make sure that goes right to that obesity rate. We need to make sure that they're getting up off the couch and putting down some of those devices and really getting out and doing whatever those activities might be. They can be as simple as shooting basketball hoops, or they can be attending a camp, right, where there's physical activity. We know that one of the pieces of research that we found out is that habits around food and physical activity develop at a really early age. Some of the research is saying by age 5 or 7. So from a really young age, we need to make sure that kids understand the importance of eating healthy foods and being physically active every day.
And we know it's a lot easier to say than it is to do, so I know it's a chore to get some of the youngsters away from the games or the television or the computer for that matter, and be able to get out and do these things here. Are there any interesting things that you've heard of around the state that are ways to be able to be more creative in ways of getting young people out there and getting that exercise that they really need?
Sure, sure. And I think it's really being that modeling and getting up with them and offering, again, to go for a walk around the neighborhood. Sometimes they can be these really orchestrated activities, but sometimes it's just taking a walk after dinner every night. You know, it doesn't have to be a big undertaking. One of the formulas that some of these experts suggested, which I think is easy for families to remember, is 5-2-1-0. Mm-hmm. So the 5 is 5 fruits and vegetables a day. 2 is no more than 2 hours of screen time. That's everything from television, phone, iPad, whatever it may be. 1 hour of physical activity every day and 0 sugary drinks. So 5-2-1-0 is one of those formulas that we can kind of keep in our minds. Doesn't mean it's always going to happen. You know, I'm a mom of 2 kids as well, and getting them sometimes to put down those devices is difficult. But if we talk about what we're shooting for every day, we're more likely to get there.
I certainly hope that's a program that's very easy to be able to perform for any youngsters here in Indiana and in Northwest Indiana in particular. And we hope that there'll be some more great ideas coming out of the IYI about this as well. We've been talking with Tammy Silverman, who is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. She's recently put out an op-ed piece. It's available to see on their website, IYI.org. And check that out for yourself if you'd like to get more information. And, of course, the website has lots of information about ways that you can help youngsters across the state as well as here in your neighborhood be able to get the help that they may need to deal with the problems that by not means their fault, certainly, that they have to be foisted with these days. Tammy, as always, thank you for spending time with us to talk about it.
Always my pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
A breed of high-tech fish is coming to Indiana, and the company producing it hopes to change the aquaculture business. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton tells us, biotech salmon could become the first genetically modified animal to be sold for human consumption.
Near no major body of water, the small town of Albany, Indiana, will soon be home to a new salmon production facility. As unlikely as the location is, the fish is just as unusual. Massachusetts-based AquaBounty will produce a GMO salmon that CEO Ron Stottish says will grow faster than fish raised in fresh water.
It does so because we've given it the ability, using the same biological process that regulates growth in the unmodified salmon, to grow about twice as fast, reaching market weight in about half the time.
The technology has been around since the 1990s, but it took until 2015 to receive approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration due to concerns about people eating genetically modified animals. University of California Davis genomics professor Allison von Inanum testified to the FDA as it was considering AquaBounty's case. She says that the protein in the fish is the same as other freshwater salmon and poses no human consumption risk.
You know, as an animal breeder, we breed for fast-growing animals all the time. I mean, if you look at a chicken today versus 50 years ago, you know, they grow more rapidly through conventional breeding, and this is just using biotech to do the same things.
Stottish contends his operation causes less harm than traditional fish farming.
We're not using coastal waterways. We're not putting antibiotics and medications into the water. Our fish are in a controlled environment. We don't need antibiotics. We don't have to treat for sea lice. You'll see in the tanks, there are barriers.
On a tour of the facility, Stottish shows several precautions made to prevent any fish from escaping.
This is the most contained facility probably anywhere in the world, anywhere in the industry. This is above and beyond anything that exists.
UC Davis's Allison von Enenum says the fish's genetic makeup also makes it unlikely they'd survive, let alone breed, outside the plant.
The fish cannot get out into wild, into the ocean, and they're also being raised as females and triploid, which makes them infertile. And so that really is a containment approach to prevent any escapement and interbreeding with the wild fish populations.
But Aqua Bounty has to swim against the current of groups that oppose the biotech fish due to environmental and health concerns. Consumers Union senior scientist Michael Hansen worries the bar has been set too low when it comes to genetically modified animals. He says the tests done to show the fish are safe were inadequate.
So rather than realize that they had a bad test because they couldn't detect anything, rather than do that, both the company and the agency concluded from that data that there were no differences in growth hormone levels between the treated and untreated fish.
But Stada says his company is a pioneer in an increasingly crowded world.
There aren't enough terrestrial resources or aquatic resources to be able to meet the protein needs of those 9 billion people.
Still, stores such as Kroger, Target, and Aldi have already announced they will not sell Aqua Bounty's biotech salmon. The Albany facility, which used to be a conventional fish farm, is still being renovated as company leaders wait on an import alert to be lifted so GMO salmon eggs may be brought from Canada into the U.S. Once the eggs arrive at the facility, it will take about 18 months before the first batch of fish is ready to go to market. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
Steve Beekman, the executive director of the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana, is now in his new headquarters in Merrillville. And we talked with him recently about the new facility and about the programs he wants to be able to take advantage of in that additional space in the way to fight food insecurity here in Northwest Indiana. Here's our conversation.
Well, Steve, you have a very, very nice place now. Certainly, I understand triple the amount of room that you had in the current space in Gary. Tell us, first off, how you came across such a wonderful place to locate the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana, and a little bit about the building and what you're hoping to do here.
What's important is to make sure that we have enough room and storage to be able to accept all food donations and food products that we acquire and distribute to our network agencies. That's most important. So we obviously need to be close next to freeways to be able to have that excess of trucks being able to come to our facility, including docks, which we don't currently have at our current location. So that's critically important, but also having the room and the space to accommodate all the number of volunteers that we get on an annual basis, because without volunteers, we're not able to do what we can do. So we have about 2,000 volunteers that come out and just to repack, sort, and put together all the meals that we distribute out, about 4.5 million meals annually that we distribute, and we can't do that without large groups of volunteers coming out to help.
Part of the plan to relocate the food bank, as you mentioned, is not only to give yourself plenty of room to be able to do everything that needs to be done, but the opportunity to be close to the sources. And you kind of mentioned the fact that obviously the highway is going to be a very important mm-hmm. part of this. What's been the problem that you encountered over the years being in the location in Gary that you hope that you'll be able to completely alleviate by being here in Merrillville? Mm-hmm.
Well, the location, the barn where we're currently at, is about 12,000 square foot. It's a barn that's been repurposed into a food bank. And so this lacks a docks and proper storage. So that in itself has been a significant challenge for us. And then the location, the proximity of freeway is important for us. Because we accept a lot of truckloads of donated product, purchased product. So that's critically important for us. So the barn has served a great purpose for us for many, many years. But because of the large need in our area and the need that we need to grow and to be able to provide more meals, we needed to find a better location to accept more food so we can distribute out to better to our network agencies throughout the region. So that's the Hammond, East Chicago, Gary, Porter County, Valparaiso, Chesterton. We need to provide more meals to the whole region. So we identified a building that will be able to not only have that easy access, but also be able to store all this type of product.
with this opportunity that you have, with this extra space that you have here now, it's obviously going to be for storage, for food, and be able to process things. But you talk about the effort that you have with the volunteers to create the meals that in turn go out from the food bank. What are you hoping that you can set up in this extra space now that, that you haven't been able to do over in Gary?
Yeah, so the lack of space at our current facility limits us not only with the food capacity, but program-wise. And so with this new space, we know that hunger and food insecurity is a major significant issue here in Northwest Indiana, and we need to provide long-term solutions to these problems. So if we're able to create these different type of robust programs and innovative approaches, we know we can serve the community better, and we're going to use the power of food to make that transformation. A lot of the programs we want to do is do a culinary job training program to teach people, unemployed or unemployed, basic skills to get them job employment, if it's warehouse job training. We know that financial stability is the number one way to get out of poverty and food insecurity. So we're trying to leverage this space and our ability to get food to make that a reality to so many people here in the region.
We're talking to Steve Beekman, who's the executive director of the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana. They are relocating from their location in Gary into a much, much larger and much more visible location on Broadway in Maryville. It's the address is 6490 Broadway, but let's just say that if you get to 61st at the light and you go south on Broadway, when you get to the railroad tracks, if you cross the tracks, you've gone too far. But that's the nice central area, and in fact, you happen to be right next door, literally, to a food processing plant of sorts here. The North Star Ice Cream Novelties plant is right next door to the food bank facility here. And obviously, they're not going to be probably much part of the food bank, but it's probably nice to have them as a neighbor, I would imagine.
Well, I mean, we're always good to have any type of neighbor, but yes.
certainly easy for people to find, and that's the point, so that organizations that rely on the food bank to supply their food pantries and the like will be able to easily, as you say, get to not only the supplies, but also to be able to get to the food bank itself. One of the things I know the food bank is working on is not only a capital campaign that's helping flesh out everything that you want to do here for this facility, but also for an even larger project too, a $4 million capital campaign that would create a hunger relief facility. Tell us about that.
Yes, so this capital campaign with a $4 million goal is to get us into this new location, to be able to build out all the new innovative programs that we want to create these long-term solutions to hunger. So this campaign will bring that to the region and be able to have this facility to be the central hub of a lot of that activity. If it's additional volunteer engagement, if it's more meals to people with seniors and kids, to people that need just an extra help and support to get them back on track and be self-sustaining.
What are projects ahead coming up going into the summer months for the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana?
Yeah, so we do have a fundraising event called the Soiree, June 10th. So our tickets are on sale now. That's a fundraiser to help with our general operating expenses for here at the Food Bank. And so we encourage people to go online, to come visit, have some of the best tastes, sounds, and music that and foods that that region has. And so we encourage people to come out for that. But for programming wise, we are starting our summer food service program where we're providing kids and youth summer meals throughout the summer. And we expect to serve about 400 kids daily, a breakfast and lunch during the summer months. And our senior box program called the CSFP program, that continues. We're serving 1,034 seniors every month, a 32-pound box of food that these seniors qualify for. And it's such an amazing program, and this program continues to grow. And we're happy to be able to provide those meals to our hungry seniors.
Now, we know that the food bank has been primarily centered around Lake County, of course, because they've been in Gary. And you'd like to do some expansion as well to some of the surrounding counties as well, too. Do you think that being in this new location on Broadway and Maryville will help you achieve that goal?
Currently, we serve Lake and Porter County, and so that's been our efforts. That's kind of our service area that defined by us and to Feeding America. The service area that we've been providing, this building will be able to, at some point, be able to serve the need in our area, which is about 17 million meals. So currently we're doing 4.5 at our current location, and we've exceeded our capacity. So this new building will be able to at least get us to meet the need currently in the region. So in the future, if there's ability to go beyond Lake and Porter County, we believe this facility could probably be able to allow us to do that.
And obviously being so close to I-65 will help too, I would imagine.
Yes, yes, yes.
What's been the reaction to folks here in Northwest Indiana once the words got around, and certainly in the planning stages of getting into this new facility here on Broadway, to being able to do this triple expansion of the food bank?
Yes, I think it's awareness is the biggest thing I see. Even our agencies too, or some of our donors, had no idea how big the issues are and how much more space we really needed. And so it's kind of an eye-opening experience to come in, to take a tour, to realize what the really big need is and how much space we really need to be able to provide all these meals. 4.5 million meals might seem like a lot, but we've been doing that out of a 12,000-square-foot barn. But the need is 17 million just to meet the need here in Lake and Porter County. So we do need a bigger facility. And so I think when people hear about this, come tour, their eyes open up. Their awareness of the need and what we're trying to do is really changes their perception of hunger and food insecurity and what we're trying to do. And I've just seen so many people excited, happy, congratulating us. But really, it's a community center. We want people to come in, to volunteer, to donate, to support this effort, because we can truly make a huge impact in this region.
I know typically that you don't rely on help necessarily from governmental agencies, in particular the places, organizations like the county commissioners here in Lake County and surrounding counties, but obviously there are ways that they, I'm sure, can probably help the food bank out, aren't there?
Yeah, so we try to leverage any opportunities to help our cause. And so if it's with individual donors, corporations, businesses, even the USDA, we provide a lot of the USDA governmental programs, CSFP, TFAP. We're leveraging those opportunities to benefit our mission. And so we continue to do that. If it's community development block grants to help retrofit our facility, we're trying to explore that opportunity because we rely on individual and donor support. Majority of our revenue comes locally, and it stays local. So it's important for us to try to turn over every rock and stone to make sure that we're trying to get every dollar possible to make this vision that we're trying to do a reality.
Steve Beekman, thanks for being with us to talk about this.
Yes, thank you.
Steve Beekman is the executive director of the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana. The food bank is physically moving its location in Gary to 6490 Broadway in Merrillville.
Since 2013, Riley Children's Hospital and Indianapolis Colts quarterback Andrew Luck have partnered for the Change the Play program, which seeks to make some positive impacts on the health and wellness of children in Indiana. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Zach Bernard tells us that the program is touring the state these days and has special hour-long camps, with the first stop in Fort Wayne.
On the count of three, let's go, Colts. Ready? 1, 2, 3.
Dozens of kids filled Bishop John M. Darcy Stadium at the University of St. Francis Monday morning, with Colts quarterback Andrew Luck in attendance. Luck says it's important to educate children at a young age on the importance of healthy habits with regard to nutrition, sleep, and stress management, among other areas.
Encouraging kids to go out and play and not spend 8 hours looking at a screen all day. And you know, to get those messages across, you got to have fun. I really believe that. And I think that's where we got some great volunteers, some great athletes from St. Francis out here helping out. Try to make sure that the kids have fun and learn something.
Two Change the Play camps took place Monday in Fort Wayne. Change the Play will stop in Evansville on Tuesday and finish its brief tour of the state with a visit to Indianapolis on Wednesday. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Zach Bernard.
Muncie Community Schools will soon be run by 7 new school board members appointed by Ball State University. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Stephanie Weekman reports, all the members are part of the Muncie community in some way, even though Ball State University's appointments were not restricted just to city boundaries.
I think it's really exciting to play an active role in a community that we already love. That's Brittany Bales. She will join six other new appointees to run Muncie Community Schools beginning next month. In a turnaround plan for the district approved by the General Assembly in May, the seven-member appointed board replaces an elected five-member board. Who's on the board? Two lawyers, two Ball State employees, one nonprofit director, one pastor, and one bank CEO. One controversial part of the turnaround plan's journey through the Indiana General Assembly gave Ball State permission to appoint school board members from outside the school's district boundaries. But only one of the new members lives outside Muncie, and just outside, still in Delaware County. Ball State President Jeffrey Mearn says that was the point of the bill's wording.
The reason the legislation, I believe, was drafted the way it was not so that we could select somebody from Brooklyn, New York, or San Francisco, but was so that we could select somebody like Mark Irvin, who's grounded in Muncie, whose life has been committed to the future of Muncie and the Muncie Community Schools, but who happens to live just a few miles away in Selma.
Board members officially begin serving on July 1st. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Stephanie Weekman.
The director of Indiana's Department of Child Services says the agency is already working on improving the culture and hiring more supervisors. There are two of about 20 recommendations that were made by an independent evaluator released last week in a very lengthy report talking about the challenges at DCS. The investigation revealed a large number of underpaid and overworked employees, as well as a high rate of reported abuse and neglect. DCS Director Terry Stignant says the agency is working on addressing those issues by making the issues like increasing salaries a high priority.
It's a significant issue for our workforce. They want to be fairly compensated for the very challenging work that they do, and this is an opportunity for us to respond to that.
Stickton says she's confident that the agency can implement the salary changes before the end of the year. Governor Holcomb's announced $25 million from the state surplus is going to go for implementing the recommendations for DCS. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back with you tomorrow, and we'll focus in on redistricting reform with the conversation we had with Lee Morris and Susan Duncan of the League of Women Voters and Mayor Joe Stahura of Whiting, and an update on some issues about this from Julia Vaughn in Indianapolis.